Well, let's see. You back there with the blonde hair. Do you have a name? Your name's George, right?
No.
Not George? What about Ephron? Is it Ephron? No? Huh. You know, it'd be nice if we wore name tags. Maybe I could remember your name. What's your name?
Tony.
Tony? Well, that's interesting. How did you get the name Tony? Did you make it up? You're pointing to your mom. Your mom gave you the name. All right, that is how we get our names. Our moms give us the name. Is there a story behind the name Tony, or is it just something your mom liked? There is one? Say that a little louder for those. Your dad gave you that name. That is. Oh, very good. Very good. Does anybody else have an interesting story behind their name? It seems like in our culture, usually it's nicknames that are the ones that have a story. My grandpa was short when he was little, and so they called him Shorty. He got tall, but he went by Shorty his whole life. If anybody called and asked for Willis, they knew it was someone who didn't know him. Well, thousands of years ago, Tony, before Jesus was born, there was a practice in the Jewish family where when a baby was born, kind of the first impression that was given was how they named the baby. So if they were really big-headed, they might have a name that indicated they had a big head. That's big head. And if it was really screamy, maybe that's loud. Well, today we have a story about someone who got their name changed by God. And they wrestled with God. Have you ever wrestled, Tony? Have you ever, like, with your brother or with the dog or parents? Do you horse around, wrestle a little bit? Have you ever heard of someone wrestling with God? Seems impossible. But you know what? Sometimes we wrestle with God in our minds and in our hearts and in our soul when we're struggling to make a right decision about something. And we know what we want to do, but we know what maybe Jesus would want us to do. And we go back and forth in our head. That's a form of wrestling. And that's an important part of our life in faith. Learning to ask questions, learning to try to problem solve, and thinking about different perspectives, whether it's the perspective of our family or the perspective of the church, and so on. So in our passage today, we get to know a man named Jacob, and he wrestles with God, and his name is changed to Israel. Okay, so, y'all, this is a really long introduction, because in order to understand this story of the name change, you need to know what Jacob's life was. So Jimmy can just cool his heels for a bit, because there's a long story. Now, I don't know if you all know this story, but we're going to go way back to his grandfather, Abraham. Now, God told Abraham something that was really significant for the Jewish faith. And he told Abraham, you are going to have a huge family. And all of your descendants are chosen. And through you and your descendants, the whole world will be blessed. They weren't chosen to win a prize. It's more like being chosen for the basketball team. You're chosen to be a player. You're going to be put in. God's going to use these people to change the whole world and make it better. Now, Abraham eventually had a son by his elderly wife, Sarah. Anyone know what that son's name was? It was Isaac. Okay, good. And so Isaac grew up and had a son of his own with his wife, Rebecca. Actually, she had two sons, didn't she? And they were born at the same time. What's that called when two babies?
Twins.
twins. They were not identical, but they were twins. And the first one that was born kind of had an unusual name, Esau. Now, Esau was named because the physical characteristic that they first noticed was that he was hairy. He was red-haired, so sometimes he's called Edom, because that means red. Esau, he was hairy. Now, does anybody remember this birth story? Esau's coming out, and Jacob is grabbing hold of Esau's heel, follows him out. There's not a big time lapse between the babies being born. So, this second son, the one that's grabbing hold of brother, is named Jacob, and Jacob means to grab hold or to strive. So we're going to call him Grabby some of the morning because it kind of helps you understand his character. And these babies had been actually wrestling in the womb. They come out still engaged. And as you know, in that culture, the firstborn gets the inheritance. The majority of the inheritance, or something for the secondborn. But Esau was barely there first. I mean, they were attached. It was almost as if it was one long birth. Can you imagine growing up as Jacob, knowing that your brother, who was just seconds ahead of you, is the one that's going to get all the inheritance and going to be the patriarch over the family? And you might even grow up knowing that when you become adults, you, Jacob, the youngest, will have to kind of bow down to the older brother. You have to do what the older brother says. Now, do you suppose there's any resentment on the side of Jacob?
Well,
yeah. Definitely. And do you think maybe his name Grabby is going to show up? Yes, it does. Now, they grow up, and Jacob seems to do work in the house. He cooks. Esau is the hunter. He goes out and hunts, and there's a story in the Bible about one day Esau comes back from hunting, and he's famished. I don't know how long he's been gone. I don't know if he has blood sugar issues or what, but he is saying, I'm so hungry. I'm going to die. I need food. And there's Jacob, Grabby, cooking some lentil stew and some fresh bread. And Esau comes into the kitchen, brother, I need some food. Does anyone know what Jacob does? He says, well, if you give me your birthright, I'll give you some food. He withheld food from his brother so that he could get his brother's inheritance. Esau must have been in a bad way because he allowed that to happen. He traded his birthright, his inheritance, for food, for a meal. But, I mean, Grabby, Jacob, that's a real caring brother, isn't it?
No.
Oh, you've been out hunting, you're starving, here, I'll trade you. Well, time went on, and eventually their dad, Isaac, was nearing death. And on his deathbed, he was also blind, so he can't see which son is which. Apparently, he could still chew, because he wanted his firstborn Esau to go hunt some game and make the stew that he so loves. And then, after he has his final meal, he's going to bless his firstborn. Now, this isn't blessings like we do. Like, I've blessed Sylvia. I've blessed anybody that wants a blessing. That's like kind of a prayer of good tidings. This is bestowing the authority of the family upon the firstborn. It's not something you can do to everybody. And Rebecca somehow has favored her youngest son. And she schemes to help Jacob steal also the blessing out from under the eldest son. So while Esau was out hunting, she had Jacob kill a baby goat. Remember, Esau met Harry, and Dad can't see his kids, but he can feel his kids. So they skin the goat. She puts Esau's clothing on Jacob so he smells like Esau. She puts the skin of the goat on his arms and the back of his neck so he feels hairy, and cooks up a stew and sends Jacob in to feed Dad the stew. And Dad's surprised that Esau hunted and cooked this game so quick, and he's kind of like, are you sure? Because he's hearing the voice. The voice isn't quite right. But Jacob says, here, feel my arms, and reassures Dad, no, I'm your eldest son. And like I said, this wasn't just a blessing of good cheer or good tidings. He is giving him the authority to be the patriarch of the family. All the other sons will have to bow down, do what he says. Anyone want to guess how Esau reacts as he walks into the room as the blessing has been given and sees that his brother, who already took his inheritance, has taken his blessing?
Angry.
Betrayed. He's hopping mad. And he goes off and he mumbles to himself, threatening and deciding how he's going to kill his brother. And Rebecca, the mom, overhears Esau's plans and sends Jacob off to live with her brother Laban. It's time for him to find a wife. She's irritated with the women in the area, so she wants him to go to this kind of her homeland to find a wife anyway. So off he goes. And Uncle Laban, as it turns out, is also a bit of a shrewd man. And after working for Laban for a month, Laban's feeling like, you know, you shouldn't work for me for free. What can I give you? Well, Jacob had seen his youngest daughter and thought, ooh, she's fine. I would like her as my wife. And so Laban says, you know what? Okay, I will give you Rachel as your wife. But first you have to work for me for 7 years. And Jacob agrees. Jacob works for him for 7 years. And after 7 years has passed, as tradition goes for their weddings, the bride and the groom celebrated with their families separately. Then the bride was taken to the room where they would live, and the groom was there, and overnight they became husband and wife. Now, if you've read this story, you know that Laban has pulled a trick on Jacob. Because Jacob wakes up in the morning to find out that they had delivered the older daughter, not the younger daughter, to his wedding room. And he is married to the older daughter who apparently had, in those 7 years, they couldn't get married off. There's something maybe a little off there. And so Jacob's mad, goes to Laban's like, you tricked me, what's up? And Laban just says, well, we don't marry off our youngest before the oldest in these parts. That's just not tradition. So they compromise. They decide, okay, spend this wedding week, this honeymoon week, with the oldest daughter, and then I'll give you my youngest daughter as your second wife. Which, that's what happened in those days. But he would owe Laban 7 more years of labor. He kind of, I mean, Jacob's been grabbing at things, so he's kind of getting a little of his own medicine, exactly. So over these years, Laban has profited from the work of Jacob. Jacob's been honorable as far as doing the best for the flocks, doing the best for the land. And they have a conversation about compensation. Now remember, what did Jacob's name mean?
Grabby.
So in this discussion, he offers Laban what seems like a very conservative, respectful offer. He says, well, you know, you've got all of these sheep, all of these goats. Occasionally, there's one born that's black or spotted. How about you give me those, and that'll be my payment. Laban agrees. It's a small percentage of the large flocks. Now, if you're reading the Bible, and this part of the story gets a little bit confusing because it's talking about breeding practices, I can't understand, but the underlying message is that Grabby, because he's in charge of the flock, changes how he breeds the sheep and goats so that the black and the speckled sheep multiply and the white are less and less. So after 20 years of living with Laban, he has a household that's flourished. He's got kids from his wives and their maids and all that. He's added servants. He's added livestock. He's decided it's time to go back home. But remember who he left back home? Esau, his brother. Do you think Esau's kind of over it? Like, no problem, come back? Probably not. And Jacob doesn't think so either. Because he sends out gifts of animals and servants ahead. Hey, go tell my brother I'm coming home. Well, they go, and they come back with the news. Esau is coming to greet you with 400 men. I don't think this is a welcome home party. So Jacob's afraid. But we know his MO, right? Benefit yourself at the cost of others. Grab what you can. Protect yourself. So he separates his entourage into two camps and thinks, well, if Esau dominates the first, I in the second can get away. And he even grabs at his faith, at his relationship with God. And he has this prayer that sounds desperate. It sounds heartfelt. He recognizes that God has allowed him to prosper and he's not worthy. And then right after he has this prayer, he decides instead to send a bunch of livestock and servants ahead in multiple groups, not just two groups. Okay, you guys separate out. So Esau's men are going to meet kind of waves of people. And then at night, when it's really not safe to be out traveling, he takes his wives and his family and all his possessions across the river to Esau's side and leaves them there and spends the night protected on the other side of the river. He's not a nice guy. And now Jimmy's going to read for us Genesis 32:22-32. And the first couple of lines that you hear is that scene where he's taking his family across.
Jacob got up during the night, took his two wives, his two women servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the Jacob River, or Jabbok River, shallow water. He took them and everything that belonged to him, and he helped them across the river. But Jacob stayed apart by himself, and the man wrestled with him until dawn broke. When the man saw that he couldn't defeat Jacob, he grabbed Jacob's thigh and tore a muscle in Jacob's thigh as he wrestled with him. The man said, "Let me go because the dawn is breaking." But Jacob said, "I won't let you go until you bless me." He said to Jacob, "What's your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And then he said, "Your name won't be Jacob any longer, but Israel. Because you struggled with God and with men and won." Jacob also asked and said, "Tell me your name." But then he said, "Why do you ask for my name?" And he blessed Jacob there. Jacob named the place Peniel. And I've seen God face to face, and my life has been saved. The sun rose and as Jacob passed Peniel, limping because of his thigh. Therefore, Israelites don't eat the tendon attached to the thigh muscle to this day, because he grabbed Jacob's thigh muscle at the tendon. The word of God to the people of God.
Thanks be to God. So you have an image of Jacob's character up to this point. And I wonder what Abraham, his grandfather, would have thought about it. Abraham's descendants were supposed to be the ones through whom God would bless the world. And instead, Jacob is striving and grabbing and wrestling and focused on his selfish interests. Since the very beginning, since his birth. Finally, maybe God has had enough. And something divine meets God, Jacob, and wrestles with him all night long. This translation said man. You'll find various translations, but it's hard to know what happened. But I suspect we've all had nights like this. Now, maybe we didn't demand a blessing. Maybe we weren't waking up with a hip out of socket. But we've tossed and turned, worried and argued in our heads, with ourselves, with others. We've grappled with big, scary, life-changing decisions and actions. That's all wrestling. But Jacob, true to his name, grabs on to this divine being and will not let go. Even demanding a blessing. It's a pretty bold action. So this being says, "All right, you know what? I will give you a blessing. And that blessing is a new name. It's a new identity. From now on, you're not going to be grabby anymore. You're going to be Israel. One who struggles with God and man and won." Now, I'm not 100% sure what it means that he won. But it seemed like when he was in his grabby mode, he was winning. It seems like in this wrestling match, he holds on and the man can't get away. But the blessing is really a call to the original purpose that God gave Abraham's descendants. Striving with God, wrestling with God, arguing, talking with God is part of the faith journey. And that turns into a core feature of the Jewish identity. They have a rich tradition of debating scripture, of applying it, and this process is more important than the answer. Now, they believe that goodness will prevail, but they're not focused on the end. They're focused on this conversation with God, that this interaction is the honor of life. Now, it might be tempting to think, oh, this is just a quaint, funny little story from the Old Testament. Doesn't really apply to me. But remember, we are children of Abraham. Therefore, we are also blessed to be a blessing to others. And so this blessing that calls Jacob back to that focus is a reorientation. It's really hard to be grabby when your focus is on blessing others or when your focus is on walking and striving with God. So there's another example of striving with God from Abraham. God's disappointed in the people of Sodom, plans on destroying the city. God even debates with himself as to whether he should let Abraham know his plan. And I think God knows Abraham's going to take him to task. And indeed, Abraham finds out, faces God, and challenges him. It says, are you really going to destroy a city if there's innocent people there? What if there's 50 innocent people there? It's not like you, God, to do this. You might recall this story, and God changes his agenda and says, okay, if there's 50 people, I won't destroy the city. 50 innocent people. But Abraham doesn't stop there. Yeah, but what if there's 5 less than that? Are you still going to destroy the city if there's only 5 less than the 50? Well, no, I won't destroy it if there's only 45. Back and forth they go until Abraham's negotiated God's level of how many innocent people will stop him down from 50 down to 10. That's a big negotiation. This is not an image of a God that's an authoritarian. It's not an image of a God that doesn't change. Abraham was holding God accountable. That's wild to me, to think a human is calling on God to do God's own good work. And in this conversation, God adjusts God's own plan. That shows me that God valued the debate. God valued the wrestling match. And isn't that what a true relationship allows? You've seen marriages where one person has all the power and the other one has no say. It's not a true relationship, not a true partnership. God created humans to have partners, to walk with on the earth, to talk with. And God doesn't want us blindly following along or just checking the boxes, right? Yep, got baptized. Yep, I go to church. Yep, I give my tithe. I'm good. That's not a life of faith. We're called to engage our hearts, our mind and soul, and God, and each other, and grapple with the big questions. This week I had an opportunity to talk with a friend who identifies himself as atheist, and we had conversations about afterlife, about God, about religion, all of that. And it was brought upon because he recently watched his mother pass away. Well, those kinds of life experiences stir up a lot of questions in folks. And these are moments of pondering, of searching, debating, wrestling, and they're holy tasks. And it's maybe less important whatever conclusion somebody comes to than it is going through the process. For Israel, the nation, their identity were the people who wrestle with God, who ask these questions, who want to figure out the problems of the world and how to solve them. So I think Grabby got one thing right. When he wrestled with that divine being, he did not let go. So many people get disappointed and walk away. They hit a bump in life's road and it's like, oh, well, God must not love me. God made this happen. Others don't want to think too hard. They do the checklist, but they don't really want to engage in that thought of those hard questions. Maybe they're afraid they're going to have to change. But let Grabby, Jacob, be an inspiration to you to grab hold of God grab hold of anyone else who's willing to have these conversations with you, to wrestle through. Not those who want to convince you of their beliefs, and not vice versa, but to be curious, to ponder, to search, and keep going until you find the truth that speaks to you. That's our lifelong task. It's why Bible study is important. It's why coming to church is important. Why having conversations with believers, non-believers, other believers is important. And having an open mind is so critical. Wrestling doesn't mean forcing our beliefs on others. It means testing and questioning our own. You may notice that our theme for the month and the sermon series is hashtag discipleship life. May your life of discipleship include plenty of wrestling. Amen.